Welcome to the Getting Real with Hillary Show, where ordinary heroes tell extraordinary stories during unique and never been heard before conversations with your host, Hillary Arno Burns. Hillary's unique listening and way of asking questions results in conversations that aren't usually talked about, so you can create the life that you really want but are afraid you can't really have. We are demonstrating the greatness in the human spirit and creating a world where we all reclaim our birthright of joy, happiness, purpose, and passion. Now, here's your host, Hillary Arno Burns. Welcome to the Getting Real with Hillary Show, and I have a very, very special guest today. Before I introduce him, I'm just going to show you my third book. Last week, I couldn't show it for some reason. Your Bullshit is Your Blessing, How to Stop Fixing Yourself and Start Having Fun. If you've ever felt bad in your life, these are tools and techniques for really creating a lot more fun in your life. So we have that book. My second book is Real Talk, How to Say the Things You've Never Said so you can have the things you've always wanted. So if you have trouble speaking up, get that book. You can go to realtalkwithhillary.com and click on the links there. And then the good old favorite, my memoir that took me 7 years to write, The Second Piece of French Toast. That was my very first book. They're all available on Amazon. And please let me know how you like them. So now I'm going to introduce my guest, Peter DeSilva. And I'm just going to show you his website. Can you believe that? So anyway, Peter, as you can read, executive leader, chairman, CEO, board member, community leader, former Harvard University senior fellow, doctor of humane letters, and author of Taking Stock. Today, we're going to be talking about Peter's book and his take on leadership. And also, so here's his book, Taking Stock. And anyway, we'll give you the links later. But Peter, you know, I always like to have people tell their stories and, you know, inspire you by how they've overcome obstacles. And so we will be talking about some of the things that Peter has overcome in an amazing, incredible way. So welcome, Peter DeSilva.
Thank you, Hillary. It's great to be with you today.
Thank you. It's great to meet you. So now, when we were talking, I call it in the bullpen, we have the halftime, we have the bullpen. Well, actually, no, baseball probably doesn't have halftime, but whatever. I'm mixing my sports metaphors. But so when you said that when you were young, you weren't able to do the physical activities like most of your friends. So you went to brain instead of brawn. But can you tell us about what happened when you were, you know, you were just going along as a regular little boy, and then what happened?
Yeah, it's been an interesting journey, but it all started as a young boy when it became apparent that something was wrong with me and my sister, who also has this disease called Charcot-Marie-Tooth disease. And it was a bit vexing for the doctors. They sort of couldn't diagnose it at first, but the symptoms were lots of falling, lots of tripping, lots of balance problems. And when I was a young teenager, they diagnosed this particular malady called Charcot-Marie-Tooth disease. And CMT, as we call it, is a progressively degenerative neurological disorder that starts in your extremities and then works its way into the inner body. So it's not life shortening, but it is, you know, quality of life changing for sure. And so, again, you have this problem with balance and falling and tripping and those sorts of things. And so that's where it all started. And I'll never forget, you know, in high school, my parents decided it was time for me to have some corrective surgeries to try to provide a bit more stability and balance for me. And my whole freshman year of high school, well, that's not right. The first half of my freshman year of high school actually was in a bed at home and didn't go to school and had to be tutored at home and such. And then, oh, by the way, my freshman year in college, we had to do the same thing to try and provide some stability for me. And you know what? The good news is those surgeries really provide some relief in the short term. There's no changing the course of this disease. There is no treatment for it. There's no cure for it. There are 3 million people around the world that have this disorder. And Hillary, I'll make a bet. Now that you're familiar with it, you're going to find someone or know someone or know someone who knows someone who has this disorder, just because it's more prevalent, I think, than people realize here in the country. But that really started me on a different path. I remember sitting down with my parents one day and they said, look, you're not going to be able to be the athlete that your brother was. My older brother was a great athlete. And my sister was had a wonderful voice. You're going to have to find your own way in life. And at that moment, I decided athletics were out, going in the military were out, things I wanted to do. And I was going to have to use my brain. And that was okay. It was just a good recognition early in life that that was going to be the path that I would have to pursue. And so I was blessed to go to UMass Dartmouth. It's where I grew up. And I came out of there with a business degree. And again, I was lucky to find a job at Fidelity Investments, and I made something of it. My parents always said that we never had everything we wanted as a family, but we always had everything we needed. And so when it came time for education, they provided an education. It was UMass Dartmouth, it wasn't Harvard, but you know what? That was good enough. That really set me on a really, really, really good course. And so I had a 35-year business career in financial services at Fidelity Investments and TD Ameritrade and Scottrade, and had a lot of senior positions in very wonderful companies. And I hope that I've left a legacy of not only a legacy of improving things, but a legacy whereby people say, you know what, I admire that person. He's a person of character. He's a person of intellect. He's a person of caring. And later, maybe we can talk about my ultimate definition of leadership, which is really about caring, at the end of the day.
Now, so can we go just go back a little bit? So, because I'm left wondering, were you athletic before you were aware of this disease, before you started falling and stuff? Were you ever athletic, or did it always hinder you, but not unknowingly?
No, it was always there. It was always present. I was never a good athlete. I could never really run. And those were some of the early symptoms that that we had to work through. I'll tell you one quick story. When I was a young boy, like all young, most young boys, I played Little League baseball. Not well, but I played. And I'll never forget this. It was, one of these bottom of the seventh inning. We only played seven innings back then. And there was a couple runners on the base, and I was at the plate, and I wasn't very good. And I remember this distinctly, where the coach said, normally you'd say, hit the bat with the ball, let the ball hit the bat. My coach said, just let the ball hit the bat. You don't need to do much. Just let it hit the bat. You don't even need to swing. Just stick it out there. So I did. And I ran down the first base. I'm like, my goodness gracious, we might actually win this ball game. But guess what happened? I tripped. I fell. And we lost the game. And so, there are those kinds of moments that can be painful, but they're also transformative. And that was the moment again where I realized, okay, I'm going to have to take another path.
So you didn't know, but you didn't know why you were falling at that point, right?
No, not really. It wasn't clear. I hadn't been diagnosed. It was clear something was up, but it wasn't diagnosed at that juncture.
So how does that disease, does it still affect you now?
Yeah, it affects you peripherally. So as I said, I had a lot of surgeries to try and give me more stability in my ankles and my legs and my feet. And I can get around. I'm not wheelchair bound. My sister is. Unfortunately, she's been in a wheelchair for 25 years. But I get around and get around pretty well overall. But it's a slow, steady deterioration. You can feel it in your hands. You can feel it in your legs and such. It's a bit of a wasting disease, which basically means that the muscles atrophy over time because they're not getting the right neurological responses. And so, you have this atrophy that goes on. But look, I'm a fighter. I'm not going down without one heck of a fight, I can tell you that.
Right. I mean, you've lasted a lot of years, right? I mean, that was a long time ago, right? When you were, I don't know how old you are, but quite a bit. So congratulations for that. Did your sister get the surgeries too?
She had some as well, and just didn't fare quite as well as I did, which was very sad. But she's a special ed teacher. She does amazing things for people in need, and I couldn't be more proud of what she does.
Well, congratulations both of you
Thank you.
for keeping on going. I mean, that's amazing. So, okay. So let's see. You also mentioned, I don't know if I'm skipping around, but you went to college, you got your job. When you mentioned kidney disease, when did that kick in? Was that young too? Yeah.
Yeah, that was right after college. So I just finished up college. So I'm 22, 23, somewhere in that range. And one day, I never forget this, just went to the doctor. I didn't feel well. I thought I had a cold or something. He literally did a very cursory exam, sort of pinched my skin, took a blood pressure, took temperature, and he literally said, "Go check yourself into the hospital." And I said, "Whoa, whoa, 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 wait a minute. I just came here because I'm not feeling that well." He says, "If you don't go
Yeah.
check yourself into the hospital, I won't be responsible for what happens to you." And I'm like, "Oh, okay." And my mother was a nurse at the local hospital. So I called her up and she called him and she said, "Yeah, you better come over," but not having a clue what was going on. And so it was a long weekend of tests and such. And they came back and said, "Look, we think you might have leukemia. There's a big mass on your left side and we're going to have to address it." I'm like, "Oh, okay, great." But we lived in a fairly small community. And so my parents took me up to Boston, where there was better care. And they confirmed and said, "Look, there's a massive mass on your left side. We're going to have to deal with it. I don't know if it's cancerous or not yet, but we have to deal with it." So, long story short, they operated, did surgery, and found a football size mass on my left side, which in essence was my kidney. It was completely blocked, it was no function, a limited function. And it had blown up in a very, very significant way. And so they removed that mass, obviously, and tried to repair the kidney, but unfortunately it was not repairable. And after a couple of attempts, we had to take it out. So yeah, that was another setback for me right after college. And again, that just set me on a path to say, you know what, maybe my health's not going to be that great. So we're just going to focus on, intellectual pursuits. We're going to focus on, in my case, business. And that served me very well.
Wow. So was that the end of the kid? I mean, were you fine after that with the kidney?
Yeah,
You just have one and
interestingly. Yeah,
yeah.
interestingly, yeah, I've got one on the
Wow.
right side. It's been perfect. I don't drink, I don't smoke, I don't do anything that would cause any pressure on it, but no, it's been terrific.
Wow. Wow.
But those things,
Amazing. Yeah.
it really changed me in a lot of ways, and they changed my leadership style, I think, as well. I felt like maybe because of my CMT and in some degree because of the kidney issues, I felt like I had to outwork everybody to overcompensate for any perceived weaknesses that I might have or any other inferiorities that I might have felt that I had. I don't feel like I had any, but I think I felt like I felt I had some. I had to prove that despite my physical limitations, I could more than compensate for that with my other capabilities. It also gave me more compassion for others. It definitely helped me understand others who have difficulty. It probably made, I know it made me a much more humble person, grateful and blessed for the things that I had. And again, back to my parents, this whole idea that you don't have everything you want, but you have everything you need. I felt the same way about myself at that point in my life. I'm like, you know what? I've got everything I need. I've got my brain, I've got a body, I've got capabilities, and I'm going to go show others. So I think humility was really ingrained into me. But there was one negative too, I think, because I think most of those are positive. One negative was this idea that I couldn't show vulnerability, that I was really trying to overcompensate in many respects for the kinds of things I was just describing. And so showing any kind of vulnerability would, in my view at that time, make me look weak. And I just felt like I couldn't do that. And I've since changed my view on that, but that's the way it was in my early 20s.
Wow. All right. So a couple questions. And I have to write them down, otherwise I forget. So that's why I went like, oh, I forgot. So was the kidney, did it have anything to do with the CMT or was it random?
Absolutely not. Completely random.
Wow. Okay. Right. That was one. The other thing was, did people know, like you said, you didn't want to show vulnerability. Did they know about any of this or did you just hide it and work hard?
I just kept it quiet. My parents
Okay.
had told me that this was my problem or our problem as a family. It was nobody else needed to know that somehow people would look different if I exposed it. And
Okay.
so you just grind through it, and it is what it is, and you don't show any vulnerability.
Wow. Okay. Now, do you think because of those two things, Well, let's just say if you hadn't had them, do you think you would have been such a hard worker? Do you think you would have achieved the success you did, trying to prove that you weren't weak? Like, or do you think you would have been that way anyway? Or do you think that's what, molded you into that person?
I think there's a bit of both in the sense that clearly these events helped to shape and mold me into who I became, for good or for bad, because there are some bad elements to it, like the vulnerability part of it. But I think I am who I am. I think that, I would have always worked hard. I would have always pursued, the kinds of things I wanted to pursue in life. And leaving a legacy is important to me. Again, what I've come to learn, though, over time is my most important legacy won't be my business pursuits. It'll be my family. It'll be my 33-year wife, Michelle. It'll be our two daughters, Christine and Sarah. Ultimately, that's what's going to matter. Nobody's going to put on my tombstone that I was president of this or CEO of that. It won't matter. It really won't matter. What'll matter is, do my values transcend down to my children? Do they transcend down to my nephews and nieces? And, will they be better people maybe for having been exposed to me?
Awesome. Well, I think as we get older, we get clearer on what's important. That's what I'm seeing, because I'm always like a doing person too. Like, okay, am I going to do another book? It's like I never stopped to smell the roses, right? Like, what am I even doing with these? Well, it was like I expected some angel to come give me a halo or something. Well, no one did. And now it's like, publish a book. Who cares? I mean, it's not like who cares because I think they're valuable, but it really never ends that strive to go, I don't even know where. And then I'm not enjoying the journey. I don't know if you've had any of that.
Yeah, I agree with that. I mean, I think you can get to a point, where it's like, what's the pursuit, right? I mean, you are pursuing something. Sometimes I'm not exactly sure what it is, what that end game is. I am clearer today that the end game is about, the people that you touch, the values that you leave, the friendships that you make. That's what's of value. A lot of the other things are interesting, but ultimately are welcome.
Yes. So now, are you still working or have you stopped?
Yeah, so it's interesting. So as my career progressed, I spent 17 years at Fidelity. I spent another 12 years at a company called UMB Financial Corporation out of Kansas City. Then I went to Scottrade, and we sold that company to TD Ameritrade. Then I went to TD Ameritrade, and we sold that company to Charles Schwab about 3 years ago. And at that point, Charles Schwab said, "You can go now. We don't need your help anymore." And I said, "That's fine. Here's a 2 year non-compete." Here's a 2 year non-compete. You got to go sit on the sidelines for 2 years. And so that is now over. So I am contemplating at this moment, what I want to do, whether I want to go back in and do another large job or whether it's something a bit more impactful on the social impact side. So I'm still thinking my way through that.
Well, I hope they gave you a package if you had to sit on the sidelines.
Well, that's
I know it's
usually the
not.
way it works.
Okay, good. I know. Otherwise, it's like, well, you can't work here and you can't work. So that's not fair. All right, good.
Right.
I know it's none of my business, but I was just, that's where I went in
No,
my mind.
it was all good. All good.
Okay, good. All right, cool. So then you say you became more, well, two things. One was, in the last couple of years, you became more vulnerable, but the other is, I guess, originally you became more compassionate. Was there a time when you weren't? I mean, were you always compassionate, or did you become it when after you went through what you went through, do you think?
Yeah, no, I always thought I was a pretty compassionate, understanding kind of young man, young person at the time. I remember my parents saying, "You have the patience of Job." I mean, I had older brothers and sisters, so I wasn't the oldest, I wasn't the youngest. I was sort of in that middle zone. So I always felt like I was patient and an understanding person, but it became clearer to me that particularly people with physical issues that I sort of have an affection for. Disability rights, as an example, is something I feel very, very, very strongly about. Not because I need it, but because others do. My sister does, as I mentioned. So it made me a much more compassionate leader. It made me more understanding of people with limitations of all kinds. And I would hope that some would say that I was supportive of them in that regard. You know, when I lived in Kansas City, I was CEO of a bank. And as you know, bankers tend to give back to their communities. They do a lot of things in their community. Bankers draw their strength from their community, so there's an expectation that they'll give back. And I did more than you can imagine in terms of events I sponsored and groups that I took care of and such. And it made me feel good, you know, that I was doing some good for the folks who needed help. And when my wife and I left Kansas City 12 years later, they gave us a big award for the what's called the Star Award for all the community work that we had done. So the whole series of things in my life just made me more compassionate, more understanding, more patient. And I think those were generally good things.
And what number kid are you? Like, how many older siblings did you have?
I'm 3 out of 4.
So you're number three. Okay. So the first two, they were fine. They didn't have the CMT at all.
No. So my older brother didn't. My sister did. She's the one in the
Oh,
wheelchair. But we sort of got
she was next.
diagnosed roughly at the same time.
And then the fourth.
My younger brother, and he's showing some signs of it now. I mean, this thing's a very sinister disease in the sense that it can manifest itself very young. It can show up at birth almost, or it can show up in when somebody's in their 50s or 60s. Or you can be completely healthy today, and there's something called a spontaneous mutation of your genes, where you could wake up tomorrow theoretically, and you know you'd have a genetic abnormality all of a sudden, and you'd end up with CMT. It's very frustrating because it can appear at almost any stage of life.
Wow. Oh,
But you
and
know what?
had your parents?
I'm super positive though, and here's why. So, you
Yeah.
know, I'm in the middle of raising some money for what's called the CMT Research Foundation. We're funding research to try to find treatments and maybe ultimately a cure for this disease. And we set out to raise $10 million about a year and a half ago, and we've raised about $6 million so far. And we've been able to
Wow.
deploy that into reading research here in the US and in Cyprus and in South Korea and in England, all over the world. And I'm thrilled that we don't have a cure yet or even a treatment, but there is some very promising science on the horizon. And for those who don't know about gene therapy and gene splicing and such, it is the future of medicine, particularly genetic medicine, obviously. And so, you know, very simply, I'll just describe the disease very simply. So we all have this protein in our body called PMP22. You have it, I have it, we all have it. Every single human being on the planet has it. I have three expressions of that protein. You have two. It's that simple, and it's that complex. It's that simple in the sense that my three expressions cause this abnormality. Yours are just fine. So what if you could either suppress the extra expression of that PMP22, right? So if you could just shut it down, great. If you could edit it out, that would be great. If you could literally go in and edit it out or splice the gene in a way that you could edit it out ultimately. And they are closer than ever to being able to do those sorts of things. So I'm very optimistic for young people today who get diagnosed with this that they won't have to go through a lifetime of pain and suffering.
Wow, and had your parents heard of it before you guys were diagnosed? Did they?
No, there was no evidence of it in the family tree, so to speak. Ultimately, it was concluded that my dad was the carrier, you know, and he had some issues later in life for sure. But as a youth, he was the most athletic guy you could imagine. I got pictures of him doing one-handed handstands and, you know, football and all that stuff. But his was later in life, but he carried it, and somehow it got passed down to the children.
It's amazing, right? Well, obviously you're making a difference for that people all over. So thank you for that.
Absolutely. Absolutely. We're going to get this done. We're going to get it
Yeah.
done.
Good. Well, it needs someone like you. So I'm sorry you have to suffer, but could be
Okay.
one of your purposes, right?
You never know. You never know why we're all here, but I'm okay with it. It's fine.
So now, did you want to talk about the vulnerable? We have 5 minutes before the commercial break about how, I know you didn't want to show vulnerability before, and then something in the past year or two changed. What was that?
Yeah, as you acknowledged, vulnerability, I viewed that as a strength, that not to be vulnerable. Like, you can't be vulnerable. You can't let others behind the facade. And that had been sort of drilled into me by my parents. And I hate the word facade because I felt like I was authentic as a person, except for this one issue. And so over time, it became more apparent that, I think I need to be a bit more authentic, if you will, with this. And I struggled with it. I really struggled with this idea of telling others about it. But after I was done at TD Ameritrade, I ended up at Harvard. There's a wonderful program called the Advanced Leadership Initiative at Harvard, and I was invited to participate in that as a senior fellow. And that program gave me sort of new insights and a new lens into lots of social problems in America and in the world. Right. So we dealt with some of the most intractable social problems you could imagine, from, everything from racism to poverty to drug addiction, et cetera. And it's just the process of sort of going through that and learning about other struggles made mine seem so insignificant. It just made it seem almost irrelevant. Here I am, looking healthy and feeling healthy by and large. And I just said, you know what? If I can help others by coming out, so to speak, and talking about this problem and raising money and doing all the things that we're trying to do, I'm going to do it. I'm going to overcome my fear of rejection and my fear of failure, and I'm just going to do it. And the reception was unbelievable. I did it first in the Harvard program, in essence. I think we had to do a report. We had to do sort of a personal journey report, and I got up and talked to my cohort about it. And I was scared to death. But you know what? Instead of rejection, I got a big warm embrace. And people have been so helpful to me since then. They want to help me raise money and all that good stuff. Coincidentally, too, are you familiar with the country music singer Alan Jackson? It's 5 o'clock
No.
somewhere. You know some of his
Okay,
songs, I guarantee you.
yeah.
Well, last fall, he sat down with Jenna Bush Hager and said, "I have CMT." And it's the first time somebody of that notoriety sat down and publicly said, "I have this disease." And when you asked him, it's so interesting. When you asked him, like, "Why did you come out now?" He says, "I didn't want to, but," he said, "I'm falling on stage, I'm tripping, and people think I'm drunk or on drugs." And he's like, "I'm not. I've got this thing called CMT." And he did a wonderful job. He went on to describe it, and he went on to talk a little bit about it. But then he said, "I don't want," and this, I think the same way. He's like, "I don't want my CMT to define me. I want my music to define me. That's the legacy I want. I don't want CMT to define me." And I feel the same way. I never wanted it to define me. CMT is what I have. It's not who I am. And, he felt the same way. So I recently wrote him a letter. I haven't heard back. I sent him a copy of my new book. I wrote him a nice letter and said, "Hey, I'd love to engage with you," but I haven't heard back from him just yet. So maybe he'll hear this on the show and he'll write back to me.
Okay. So, and did, because that's what, this book that I have, it's talking about stuff like I call it saying what can't be said, all that stuff that we're afraid to say. Mine is I'm a people pleaser. I don't want anyone to get upset. It's more that flavor than thinking I'm weak. Well, thinking I'm crazy. I mean, that's one of the things too. But, because I'm a worrier and I get paranoid and needy and all that, and I don't want people to know that. But this is, the whole thing getting real is about being that real self. Yes, sometimes I worry. Sometimes I am so insecure I can't even like function, and to just own that part instead of hiding it. It's not a disease, but it's my shtick. It's whatever. And coming out. I think we all have stuff that we come out with that we've hidden, shame stuff. And what I found is when I've said it, not only has no one judged me, but it's opened up something for them to be able to talk about what they don't talk about.
100% correct. I think you're 100% correct. And by being authentic, you're going to get authenticity back, right? And that's what I had to learn. I had to learn that, I like I said, I was always thought I was authentic, except maybe for this one little issue. And but when I opened up about it, all of a sudden people open up back. And they wouldn't have done that necessarily, but now they realize that you're showing some vulnerability, they're willing to show some vulnerability as well.
Yeah, and did it open up something for you that now you weren't hiding this? Like, did it open up some freedom in your life?
Oh, 100%.
Yeah.
100%. Made me feel like I can truly be the person that I am, for good or for bad. And like I said, we've been raising money, and I've been out talking to friends of mine who said, "Wow, I had no idea, but now that I know, how can I help?" I mean, it's been really remarkable.
Wow. That's so great. Okay, so now. Well, good. We're going to explore some leadership and so your book in the next half, but now we're going to go to our sponsor and we'll hear from them right now. So stay tuned.
Do you ever feel like you can't say what you really want to say? Or that you're stuck or in a holding pattern in your relationships, career, personal life, or finances? Are there things you want in life that you've given up on? Are you resigned that this is as good as it's going to get? If you answered yes to any of these questions, then Hillary Burns, host of the Getting Real with Hillary Show, has the solution you need. Hillary is a published author of 3 books and has a program called the Getting Real Process. This process frees you from what is holding you back, allowing you to create a life you love. Don't believe it? It is hard to believe that it could work, isn't it? The proof is that hundreds of Hillary's clients have used the Getting Real process and are now free to create whatever they want in relationships, career, finances, enjoying life, or just loving themselves more. So go to realtalkwithhillary.com and order Hillary's book, Real Talk, and set up a conversation.
Has social emotional learning become just one more thing on your teachers' plates? Do teachers and students both find it boring and ineffective? Then bring Kikori to your school. Kikori transforms classrooms through experiential SEL activities that help students play, reflect, connect, and grow. Even better, students say it's more fun than recess. Schedule a no obligation conversation at kikoriapp.com/bringkikori. KIKORI.
So thank you to our sponsors. KikoriApp.com. That's my daughter works for that company. That was her voice. I always have to tell people that. And it's a social emotional learning app for teachers, which can really, heal what kids lost during COVID when they had no, connecting and social connecting. So anyway, I recommend it highly. Go to KikoriApp.com and connect. And then, of course, realtalkwithhillary.com, our other sponsor. So, also, I have to put a plug in for my photographer who took this picture. I ran into her after all these years, and she was like, you're supposed to check with me before you use that photo. And I was like, oh, I had no idea. So, anyway, Suzanne Gold, get in touch with me. I can put you in touch with her if you need a headshot. She's really talented. And, I always tell people, they say, well, you don't look like that anymore. And I'm like, well, I don't think I ever did. But it's a great picture. So we use it. Anyway, Suzanne Gold, amazing photographer. And here we are back with Peter De Silva. And we're going to start talking about leadership. Well, is there anything else about the vulnerability and when you started talking about stuff like, what kind of stuff did other people? Open. Well, I'll give you an example. When my dad died, and I went to some clients, and I was still upset, obviously, and I shared it and what we went through and stuff, and I saw the difference in them. They opened up about what they were going through, and before that, it had just been like professional and stuff like that. I sell Aflac; that's what I do by day, and but it really opened up something in our relationship. All of a sudden, we were connected. All of a sudden, we were vulnerable. All of a sudden, we were talking about what happened personally. And for me, it was much more enjoyable. than when it was just, business. So did you find that as well when you started talking that people started telling you stuff too?
Yeah, 100%, Hillary. That's exactly right. And I think it's this idea that, if you're vulnerable to someone, they're going to share some of their, they may share some of their vulnerabilities. And I had that happen to me like quite a bit. And then you are like, wow, I had no idea. And they're like, wow, I had no idea. And all of a sudden, this level of transparency really, really builds, and that friendships deepen. Even business relationships, to your point, those aren't friendships in the classical way, but I do think they take on a different life, right? They become more real, they become more authentic, they become more practical in a lot of ways. And so even if it's not a friend, I think when you're as open as you can be, people respond positively to that.
Yeah, there's like a connection, like it's not physical, but it almost is that you feel connected in a deeper way to people when you know something about them. Yeah, it's interesting.
100%.
Yeah. So let's talk about your book and what had you, I know you had said you became more compassionate through, what your challenges, but what had you want to write a book? What's the background there?
It's a good question. I had spent 35 years in the business world, and over time I would jot these ideas down. I would see something occur and I'm like, that's a principle. That's going to govern my actions in one form or another. And so over time I had all these notes and all these thoughts about things that I felt were really important. And as a leader, one of the things I would always do when I inherited a new team is I would sit down and articulate these principles and say, guys, here's what I believe. Here's how I like to function as a group and as individuals. And people always responded well to that. One, because I think it's a rare leader who's like day one says, here are the principles we're gonna adhere to. But I also think they felt there was some value in them because they really helped to talk about how we were going to work together and how we were going to care for each other. You end up spending more time with your colleagues sometimes than you do with your family. And so it's important that you have, a great relationship there. One of my principles is to lead by principles and not rules. If you think about the distinction between, oh, I don't know, the Code of Hammurabi, which is 282 rules, they're very prescribed. If you do this, you will be stoned. And that has been relinquished to the dustbin of history, thankfully. And then if you contrast that with, for example, the Declaration of Independence, which is very principle-based, all men are created equal, what it means. I mean, now it doesn't then go on for 82,000 words to explain that means, that you're going to treat people with respect and dignity. No, it doesn't need to say that because it's inherent in what is said. So I'm a big believer in leading by principles, not a bunch of rules, and providing people the framework, if you will, within which they can function well.
Wow. You just blew my brain with that one. I mean, because sometimes I say, when people are unreasonable or whatever, their rule, I say they're rule people. They're following the rules even though they don't make any sense. And
Correct.
so the principles that just,
Go
what
all
a
the way
great,
back up.
did you come
Take
up with
it
that
up.
yourself? Did you come up with that yourself or did you read it somewhere? I mean, it's just, I love it's so simple. It's just so simple, but makes so customer service. Hello, Yeah.
Right. Well, another one of my principles, which I fundamentally believe in, and I hope that people who've worked with me have seen this, goes like this. It says, if you take care of associates, they'll take care of clients, and the rest takes care of itself. It's a very simple leadership model, but candidly, it's the most effective one I've ever put forth. So that's one of the principles I share with my groups when I get together with them the first time. It's like, guys, we're going to start inside, because if we don't have the inside right, there's no way we're going to be able to treat our clients right with respect and dignity and such. And that resonates very, very, very strongly with people. And I'm also a quantitative guy. And so one day I said, how can I prove this quantitatively? Like, I want to be able to prove this thesis quantitatively. And so I went to my finance and HR team and I said, guys, help me figure out how to do this. And they said, well, there's really three variables, right? So you have a variable called what's the associate engagement? Like, what's the satisfaction of our team? Okay, got it. And then what's the client engagement? Oh, okay, that makes sense. And we know there's a correlation between those two. And then what are the financial results for the company? And so we went and for like a decade, plotted all these numbers. And we looked at how associate engagement was positively correlated to client engagement, which was positively correlated to outcomes, in this case, financial results. And it was just a very powerful way to be able to prove that this thesis about taking care of the inside really led to the results that we were hoping to
How
achieve.
did you measure associate engagement and client engagement? Did you have how did you measure that?
Yeah, so we had a bunch of surveys that we used
Oh,
for
okay.
both clients, internal clients, associates, and our external clients. And we
Okay.
tried to keep those surveys consistent over about a decade so that the results were reliable. And we used to put in the annual report every year. It was my favorite chart, and it was really the only chart that mattered to me. It's like, okay, associate engagement, client engagement, and results. And I took a hint too from Michael Dell. When Dell was on fire, we're talking 20, 25 years ago, and he could do no wrong. We'll never forget this. He was at his
Yeah.
annual meeting, and he asked for the slideshow to be put up. And so the slideshow was put up for him, and there was one slide, and the slide was the stock price of the company. And he said, "Are there any questions?" And that was his entire speech. People clapped, and he sat down. It's always about the results. I'm as focused on that, but I'm focused on how too. I'm focused on how you get to the outcomes that you're looking for.
And what were the so the associates filled out a survey and the clients filled out a survey, and then what was the financial result that you could measure from those engagement pieces? What numbers were you measuring?
So we used a number of numbers, but certainly earnings would be one, revenue growth would be another, return on average equity, return on average assets, some of the basic
Yeah.
financial ratios that you use to judge a healthy company.
And were the I don't know, I'm just interested in this. So were there times when the associates and the clients were not engaged that you could measure that it was down, or was it always because you were focused on it was always going up?
It was always a positive correlation, but it was at different rates of speed. So
Okay.
some years, for example, if you're in the investment business and you're having a bad market environment, your clients aren't happy no matter what.
Right.
Just to be clear, nobody likes to lose
Yeah,
money, right?
right.
So there were different rates of speed based upon some external variables. But what we were able to tease out is that the internal variables in most cases overcompensated for that.
Oh, that's so cool. All right. So what are some other principles that you introduced? If you don't mind, I mean, I'm assuming that's what's
No,
in your book.
it is. It is. I
It's
mean, so the
great. It's
book
great stuff.
is organized a little bit around these 10 principles. And again, they were formed from a practitioner's standpoint, not an academic standpoint. I think that's very important. No disrespect to many wonderful academics who've written books on leadership, but to be honest, they've never had to do it. They've never been a practitioner. So I come at it through a practitioner lens, not an academic lens. So another one might be, take intelligent risks on emerging leaders. And so just a short story. So when I was a young leader at Fidelity Investments, one day my boss Fred walked in my office and he said, "Peter, we've got a great opportunity for you." And I'm living in Boston at the time with my wife and one daughter. And he said, "But it involves relocating to Kentucky." And I said, "I don't think I know where that is, but and I'm really not interested in doing that." But long story short, eventually he convinced me by basically saying, "If you don't, you probably don't have a job at the company." He convinced me I should do that. And that's the way it was, by the way.
motivated you.
30
He
years
motivated.
ago, that's the way it was. I mean, your boss
Oh.
came in and said, "Your desk is moving to Kentucky. Are you going or not?" And either way is
Yeah.
fine. Today, of course, it's a different world. So anyway, so I moved to Kentucky, and it was a turnaround. Or it was part of the operation that was struggling. So it was a bit of a turnaround. And Fred would come down every week. Every week he'd come down, go in his office, read the newspaper, put his feet up on the desk, call a few people, and then go home. I'm like, "Great that you're here. And if I need anything, yeah, I know you're here, but I'm not quite sure why you're coming every week. But whatever." So this went on for 2 years. And one day I finally finished the job. They moved me back to Boston after about 2 years. And one night I'm at a cocktail party with Fred's boss, Mark. And I said, Mark says to me, he says, "Peter, I'm so proud. You did a great job." And he said, "To think, most of us on the executive committee didn't think you could do it." And so I paused for a minute. I looked at him. He looked at me. He knows he just made a faux pas, and he moves on to another conversation. But the next morning, I walk into Fred's office, and I'm like, "Okay, you got to level with me. What was that all about last night?" And he said, "It's not a big deal." He said, "It all worked out great for you, right?" I said, "Yeah, it all worked out great." And he said, "So don't worry about it. Just don't worry about it." I'm like, "Fred, I have to know." And he said, "Look, you were a young guy. You were probably, I was pushing you ahead of where you probably were. I knew you, I had confidence in you. I knew you could do it." And I stopped him and I said, "Now I understand. The reason you came out there wasn't because you thought I needed help. It's because you were giving them an assurance that you were there if anything went wrong." And he looked at me, kind of looked at the floor, and just said, "Hey, it all worked out." And I really took that to heart, and it became part of my leadership style to take risks on young leaders. Now, here's the quid pro quo, though, Hillary. And I call this, I use this euphemistically, to build a fence around them, to build a fence around those people. Fred was my fence. He was not going to let me fail. He wanted me to have all the learnings. He wanted me to grow. He wanted me to develop. He wanted to accelerate my growth and development, but he wasn't going to let me fail. And yes, he had self-interest, by the way, because he put me down there. But at the end of the day, I really took that away, and I have this saying now that you build fences around talent. It's part of my job as a leader is to build fences around young talent. And I actually believe this will be a bit controversial, maybe, but I actually believe that near failure is a better teacher than actual failure. Because the way I operate is I allow my people within those boundaries, those fenced in area, to do whatever it is they think they need to do, right? Whatever decisions they need to make, whatever actions they need to take, that's fine. But what sometimes I'll see them approaching the edge of the fence, and I'm like, "You know what? Come over here. Let's have a conversation. Tell me why you're doing that. Tell me why you think that's the right decision." Oftentimes they convince me it's okay. Other times I'm convinced it's not okay. So they get all the learning associated with that event, but they don't have the pain of actually failing.
And how do you know that they're close to the side? Like, so you're watching, they're obviously they're in communication, they're telling you what they're doing, they're telling you about decisions they're making, and then you're just going, you're watching. Right? Is that it? I mean, obviously you're in dialogue or you wouldn't know, correct?
Right. Yeah, you're in dialogue, you're watching, you're looking at the measurements and reporting, you're talking to others. Sometimes you just talk to others, like, you should ask him a few questions and see if he thinks he's on the right track. So you're talking to others. You have lots of different ways to gather that intelligence without compromising the individual. But the important lesson is to sit down and say, "Okay, help me understand why you think that's the right decision." Sometimes they can't justify it. And it's like, "Oh, I just think it is." I'm like, "No, that's not an answer. That you got to explain to me why you think it is the right decision." And sometimes they can't. And so you tell them, "You don't think that's a wise course of action."
So it's understanding what's behind their actions so you can help them. Yeah, that's
For
great.
sure. For sure.
Awesome.
So it's just been a something I learned early in my career. The other thing I would say is the value of mentors cannot be overstated. And mentors, by the way, shouldn't necessarily be in your line of sight. They shouldn't be your boss. I mean, they can be, but look for people both inside the organization and outside the organization who can mentor you. And I've had many people call me up and say, "Would you mentor me?" And I'm like, "Okay, yes, I'll do that." But the quid pro quo for that is there's going to be honesty, there's going to be transparency, and you may not like some of what you hear. But that's if you want that, then let's do it. But I had great mentors. Fred is a good example of a very early mentor who took a risk on me. It paid off for him, candidly. It paid off for me as well. And it really accelerated my learning. And I think one of the most important things we give back is this mentoring to the next generation so that they can be successful leaders as well. I mean, the great leader,
So,
I think of it this
yeah.
way, Hillary. So, Howard Schultz, who was the founder and creator of Starbucks, right? Many people would say he's an awesome leader. And in many respects, he was a great marketing executive, great leader in many respects. Do you know how many times he's had to go in and run Starbucks? He's on his third time now. So, in other words, he runs it, he finds a successor, he doesn't like the successor, fires him, the board brings him back. It's just happened three times. And so when people say somebody like Howard Schultz, who I respect, is a great quote leader, I have to question that, because a great leader would make sure that he or she developed people, had the right folks in the number two, number three, and number four positions, and they can walk away. Great leaders can't be judged until they're gone, until they're no longer in that position of leadership. And if they leave and everything runs along perfectly well, then they were a great leader. They prepared the organization, they prepared the people, they did a great job. If, however, the place falls apart after they leave, I question whether they actually were a strong leader or not.
Interesting.
That's a
Thank
perspective.
you.
That's a perspective.
Yeah, no, I love it. I can't wait to read to get the book and read the rest of the principles. We have about 4 minutes left. Where would you love to be in 5 years? I know you said you do some speaking, you have the book, you've been having your 2 years. If you could just imagine like the best possible scenario for yourself, what kind of difference would you have made, or where would you be in 5 years, do you think?
So I'll give you a few thoughts on that. One, we will have found a treatment for CMT. That would be number one. I don't know that we'll get to a cure, but a treatment would be great for the 3 million people that suffer with it around the world. So that'd be number one. Number two, I will have given back in some other ways, mentoring young people, taking care to ensure that the next generation of leaders is ready for the challenges that they're going to be confronted with. That'd be number two. Number three, I would hope that my family, my two daughters, my wife, we're still going strong. Everything's, that they're a wonderful, we're a wonderful little cohort. And I would hope and expect that that family unit would still be, intact, and that we'd add to it, hopefully, with son-in-laws and maybe some children or whatever the case might be, grandchildren, whatever the case might be. So that's important to me, as well. And at the end of the day, as I said earlier, nobody's going to write on my tombstone or my epitaph, that I was CEO of this or that. What they're going to say is, I hope they say is, here lies a good man. Here lies a good person, an ethical person, a moral person, a person of character. That would be good enough for me.
That's awesome. One of the things, it seems like you believe in people. Some people think the worst of people and expect the worst or look for them to fail. Whereas it seems like you, I don't know if it was a natural thing for you, but that Fred believed in you then, send that down the line. And I think, the world could be a better place if we all believed in people instead of letting our egos run, trying to step on top of everyone to make ourselves look better or the insecurity. I mean, I have it. I get jealous and compare, and it's, that's when I pull out one of my books to get back to the other side where there's connection and love, but it's not always automatic. How did you, and I know we only have like a minute, but was there any particular moment where you became that, or you were always looking for the best in people?
Yeah, I don't think I could pinpoint a moment, but one of the principles that I always talk to my teams about is this one. It's assume positive intent. Until proven otherwise, you have to assume positive intent with your friends, your colleagues, your neighbors, your co-workers, whatever it might be. And I think that does a lot for me. Yeah, there may be other other thoughts people have, but if you start from that position, yes, you're going to be disappointed from time to time, but more often than not, you're not going to be.
Well, there's a guy that I was taking some courses with who said, children especially, but all of us, we mean well. We don't not mean well, but because of our stories and our brains, people, oh, they're offended and all that stuff. But the world would be different if people just assumed positive intent. So anyway, thank you so much, Peter. This has been fabulous, fascinating. Let me see if I can go back to your website here. Here it is. We're with Peter Da Silva Hansa. That is like the best picture. I just that's so
Thank
awesome.
you.
I don't know if that's sexist, but that's what I'm saying. And here's his book, Taking Stock. Is it available on Amazon? They can get it.
Amazon and pretty much any of the online bookstores and physical bookstores as well.
Okay. And how do they reach you if they wanted to have you speak or something? Is there a way on here?
Yeah,
Or.
go to peterjdesilva.com, which is my
Okay.
personal website, and you can send me a message or we can connect that way.
Okay, so Peter J.
De
Da
Silva,
Silva,
yep.
DESILVA.com, and you can connect with Peter that way. Well, thank you so much, Peter. This has been great. It's great to meet you, and I look forward to hearing more about all the wonderful things you're doing in the world.
Well, thank you,
Anything you want
Hillary,
to
and thanks
say?
for all you're doing. Well, thank you for all you're doing for all of us in the world. So thank you. I look forward to being with you again.
Yes, awesome. When you get the cure, when you get the treatment, we'll let people know. Yeah, awesome.
Indeed,
Thank you.
indeed.
Thank you.
Thank you for listening to the Getting Real with Hillary show. We hope you are entertained and inspired. Please subscribe to Hillary's newsletter. Go to gettingrealwithhillary.com for more freedom techniques and fantastic stories and links to other great stuff. And don't forget to tune in every week on Tuesdays at 1 p.m. Eastern Time on BBS Radio TV. And let's get real. Let's get connected. Let's get inspired and create that life you love.